This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. About a decade ago, I went to a well-to-do suburb north of Tel Aviv to meet with a youngish Israeli politician whose name was Naftali Bennett. I showed up at his house, and it was big, it was modern, it had flat-screen TVs. And we sat outside, and he talked about his years in the software industry and working as a chief of staff to Benjamin Netanyahu. Bennett was something pretty new in Israeli politics. He promised, I wrote then, to build a sturdy electoral bridge between the religious and the secular, the hilltop outposts of the West Bank and the startup suburbs. Bennett was fluent in Facebook. He quoted Seinfeld as much as he did the books of the Talmud. And he had been a leader of the settlers, but he no longer lived in a settlement. Yet there was no ambiguity at all about Bennett's stance on the Palestinian question. He was a hardliner. He disdained the peace process of an earlier time. I'll do everything in my power to make sure they never get a state, he told me. No more illusions. Naftali Bennett is now the Prime Minister of Israel, having unseated Benjamin Netanyahu, who was the longest-running Prime Minister in the history of the state. Last week, I reached out to two writers in the region, one Palestinian and one Israeli, to talk about this political upheaval.
Ruth, how are you?
Hi.
How's it
I'm
going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
It's fine.
It's good to see you. Ruth Margulies lives in Tel Aviv, and she reports for The New Yorker from around the region. Now, Ruth, the coalition that brought Naftali Bennett to power just now is all over the map politically, but he himself, obviously, is very hardline on the Palestinian question. The coalition loathes Netanyahu, but I'm not quite sure how anything is going to change where the Palestinian question is concerned. Do you?
I don't see how it's going to change, at least not in the short term. I think there are some promising signs in the sense that it's, you're right about Naftali Bennett, that he himself is very much a hardliner, but it's also an alliance. You know, he only won 7 seats out of 120, so he's really reliant on these other factions. And among them are, you know, 2 left-wing parties. We have, for the first time ever in an Israeli government, we have an Arab party. So there are these sort of promising, kind of cautiously promising signs. But you're right. I mean, will the life of a Palestinian family living in Gaza change next week because Netanyahu is no longer in power and Bennett is? No, the answer is no, not yet.
And this change also comes in the context of a yet another conflict in which there was rocket fire and then bombing from Israeli fighter jets and hundreds dead, mostly Palestinians. And this has had an effect on Palestinian politics, and it's also had an effect on Palestinian Arabs in Israel. And you've reported on this. Tell us what's changed.
Well, I think for the first time in a long time, we're seeing this kind of cross-Palestinian sort of solidarity movement. You know, until now, whenever there were tensions in Gaza, in other places, it didn't necessarily mean that things would sort of spark up in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem. And inside Israel, not at all, you know. And I mean, occasionally, but this was very rarely the case, that Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are known in Israel as sort of Arab Israelis, they never really joined this kind of pan-Palestinian movement. And now they have. And I think partly it's because, you know, Netanyahu, after a decade, more than a decade in power, made life really very untenable for them inside Israel, for these Arab Israelis. And so there's a deep sense of frustration and despair. And we saw the sparks of that. Now, on the other hand, you can say, well, I just said that we have an Arab party joining the government for the first time. So how doesn't that mean that suddenly they're sort of integrating and are taking part in political life? But I think this Arab party that joined the coalition isn't really speaking about a two-state solution or any kind of solution for that matter. They're sort of talking about getting budgets passed, you know, making life inside the Arab cities and villages safer. There's a deep sense in which after all of these Netanyahu years, people inside Israel and maybe outside of it have kind of lost hope for a peaceful resolution, even though I think it's not dead yet.
But yet the shift seems on both sides of the Green Line toward a greater obstinance, greater radicalization.
I think the last round of escalation in Gaza was really a turning point. I think part of what is really frustrating about these years of Netanyahu's rule and kind of this rightward shift, he kind of made, it sounds crazy, but he made Hamas sort of kosher in a sense for many people outside of Israel. Well, in the sense that, you know, the despair is so immense, and the pictures coming out of Gaza were just incredibly just heartbreaking for everyone to watch, that it was almost as though Hamas was seen as a kind of reasonable alternative. And of course they're not, you know, and from my perspective, you know, I've also seen the great damage that they've caused, Hamas, and the, you know, the suicide bombings inside Israel of the 90s that have now been replaced by, you know, rocket fire and other, you know, I think it points to a real crisis if that's the alternative sort of Palestinian movement that is on the rise now.
It never seems to get better and seems only to get worse, and at the same time to be only fitfully paid attention to in recent years.
I think that's true. But can I also say that maybe something now after this, you know, something is shifting in Israel, and I think we have to give it time, and maybe there'll be signs of hope. I don't know yet, but suddenly something is happening here. So it's worth, you know, paying attention to.
Raja.
Hi.
It's good to see you, if even through this strange technology.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Raja Shahada is a lawyer and a writer, and he's based in Ramallah in the West Bank. So Raja, Naftali Bennett is now Prime Minister of Israel. How is this news being received in Ramallah?
Well, the news in Ramallah about the elections is that it doesn't make much difference between Benjamin Netanyahu and Naftali Bennett. I think it does make some difference, but essentially they're on the same track. It makes a difference as far as Israel is concerned, because Netanyahu is harming a lot of the institutions in Israel. But as far as the Palestinians are concerned, they're made from the same cloth.
Have the Palestinians given up on Israeli politics completely? I mean, what possible hope can be found in the Israeli political scene? The left is practically a dead letter.
Unfortunately, that is true. I read this speech to the Knesset of Naftali Bennett, and there's nothing in it about peace education, about making peace with the Palestinians. It repeats the same old stuff, that the Palestinians don't recognize the existence of the Israeli people, Jewish Israeli people on the land, and that they will continue with the settlements, and that they will stop the building of Palestinians on what is called Area C, which is 60% of the territory of the West Bank. There's not much hope, nothing to hold on to hope in the coming regime. At the same time, ultimately, it's only through Israel that we can make peace. And so it's very disappointing that there isn't a political structure in Israel which calls for peace, through peace with the Palestinians, or a recognition of the existence of the Palestinians.
What is the political effect, the political aftermath, and even the psychological aftermath among the Palestinians of the recent conflict in last month?
Well, the Palestinians, unfortunately, have come to see that making an arms struggle with the Israelis works to some extent, because now the Israelis consider how the Palestinians are going to react. And they never did that. They just bombed Gaza without having any consideration that there will be a reaction. Now, at least, they're considering there is a reaction. This is on the one side. On the other side, the Hamas won a lot of support amongst the Palestinians, because the Palestinians in the West Bank, for example, could see that the strategy that the Palestinian Authority was following, which was to kneel down to the Israelis to try and get negotiations going and so on, and making concessions, all of that was not getting them anywhere.
Hamas is considered a terrorist group by the United States and elsewhere in the world, and it's not had a chance to run an election beyond Gaza. How would an election, if it were permitted by the Palestinian Authority, come out?
If elections take place, Hamas will win.
Roger, could you see yourself voting for Hamas after all these years?
I think it's a tragedy to see it that way, because Hamas stands for everything I don't like. And Hamas, if it ruled here, would curb individual rights. And the same problem with the Arab party in Israel, which is now part of the government. It stands for everything that the secular Palestinians in Israel do not want. And likewise with Hamas.
Roger, forgive me for being rude, but how old are you?
I'm about to be 70.
So you're 70 years old. The situation is what it is now. Do you hold any hope for there being any kind of peace, any kind of reconciliation, any kind of true political deal with Israel in your lifetime?
I think not, because the way I see it, Israel is not moving towards the essentials for peace. And for me, the essentials for peace are coming to terms with what the, Israel did to the Palestinians in the course of its establishment. And there's no indication whatsoever that there is movement in that direction. And so as long as Israel denies that the Israel was established on the backs of the Palestinians and by forcing the Palestinians out of their land, I don't see any possibility for real peace.
Of course, many Israelis would be quick to point out that how is it possible to make peace with the particularly Hamas-led Palestinians, whose charter calls for the elimination of the State of Israel?
The charter of the Likud and the Israeli government is no less fanatic than Hamas, because they say all the land of Greater Israel, is, which includes the West Bank and Gaza, is Israel. So if you want to look at who is fanatic, Israel is fanatic as well as Hamas is fanatic. So it's not really just the fault of Hamas in this regard.
Roger Shahada, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Roger Shahada is based in Ramallah, and I spoke with Ruth Margalit in Tel Aviv. You can find both of their writings on Israeli politics and Palestinian politics at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We've been hearing a great deal lately about what happened in Tulsa in 1921. It's sometimes referred to as a riot, but it was far, far worse. It was a direct, horrific attack on the black community of Tulsa. Scores of people were killed. An entire neighborhood was burned to the ground. This was one of the deadliest episodes of racist violence in the long and terrible history of Jim Crow. And yet, for most of this century, the Tulsa Massacre was little known except to historians, and the memory of it was deliberately suppressed in Oklahoma and well beyond. Our story today is part of a new podcast called Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning. It was produced by our colleagues at WNYC Studios, along with the History Channel, KOSU in Oklahoma City, and Focus Black Oklahoma. We're going to start now years before the massacre, when the Greenwood District was very much on the rise. This was during the oil boom in Oklahoma, and Greenwood became so prosperous that it became known as Black Wall Street. Tulsa Burning is presented by one of the producers of our program, Kalalea.
When I started learning about the history of Greenwood, one of the things I had to get up to speed on was Oklahoma's guardianship laws. Oil drilling had made the land there really valuable. Guardianship was one of the ways that white settlers had of stealing that land away from the five native tribes and the black freedmen who owned it. The scheme was so brazen that it came to be known in Oklahoma as the guardianship racket.
Land ownership laws in Oklahoma were pretty soft, pretty porous.
That's Koresh Ali Lansana. He teaches Africana studies and creative writing at Oklahoma State University, Tulsa.
Anyone who was appointed by the courts could make a claim that these Native American parents were incompetent or unfit to raise their children and to steward their land. And the court would just say, pretty much, okay, you now have custody of the children and the land.
As part of the guardianship racket, people, mostly white, would petition to gain control of those children and the lands they owned.
The courts generally granted those petitions based on even flimsy claims of incompetence or unfair treatment or that the parents were insane. And then they would become the new guardians of the land and the children. And then they would do what they would with the children and strike it rich via oil, or it was fertile land for grazing of cattle. And the Native American folks who lost their land were just out, just, you know, now poor and without property. One of the more famous cases was a Creek freedman, Warrior A. Renty. Renty's family owned 1,600 acres, about $120,000 per year in royalties.
That was a lot of money back then, the equivalent of some $1.6 million today.
And this was a big deal because, you know, he was an attorney and a journalist, so he had some means.
Now, Warrior A. Renty wasn't your typical turn-of-the-century Oklahoman. He was Muscogee Creek, black, and highly educated. And he was rich, mainly because he inherited a large estate from his sister, and each of his 8 children had their own land allotments.
So in 1910, Renty received a letter that a new guardian was appointed to his children, and he'd be losing his family and losing the land. He actually went to the officials and said, "You would take my land and my children over my dead body." He was arrested and spent a brief time in jail.
But Renty had an important ally, a journalist from Muskogee, Oklahoma. His name was A.J. Smitherman.
Smitherman is passionate. He's engaged. He is a leader in so many ways.
Except not in the ways that most Oklahomans were used to.
This is a black man with a great deal of agency, right? A great deal of power, and wasn't afraid to let folks know what was on his mind.
There was no accountability, and my great-grandfather called it the dispossession of wealth. And that's exactly what was happening. My name is Raven Mejia Williams, and my great-grandfather is A.J. Smitherman.
Smitherman saw the guardianship laws as just another scheme by the state to give white people the resources and legal cover to seize black and native land. He was also a practicing attorney. He took up Renty's case and won. During that investigation, he uncovered more than 3,000 other cases in the region, amounting to over $100 million, stolen from Native children. He wrote about it in the local newspaper.
The biggest game of graft in the state today is the guardianship graft. They have Jim Crowed us, attempted to disenfranchise us, taxed us without giving us representation, and after doing all of this, they are clamoring to be guardians of our children. The children of the race they have so grossly wronged.
It became a worldwide known scandal because Oklahoma was one of the largest metropolises of oil in the world. And that's, I think, the beginning of my great-grandfather's realization of just how much you can influence things using a newspaper.
A.J. Smitherman was born in Alabama in 1883, less than 20 years after the abolition of slavery. His parents named him Andrew Jackson, like the president. And when he was a baby, his family moved to Muskogee, Oklahoma. His father worked as a coal miner and his mother a school teacher. In a way, Smitherman was a child of Oklahoma. He was European, Native, and African, just like a lot of people there. But in the eyes of the state, he was black and subject to all the restrictions that came with it. Smitherman went to college and then law school, a rarity for a black man at the time. He had a powerful voice, in person and on the page.
The saddest and bitterest time in the life of the American Negro is that time each year when he is called on to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars into the treasury of a government of which he has little or no reputation.
He was unafraid to speak his truth, to speak his mind, to share his opinions, and he was bold and therefore considered dangerous in that regard.
Quraysh Ali Lassana has been studying Smitherman for decades. Back when he was a young journalism student, he became fascinated by Smitherman's skill and versatility as a writer.
And not only was he writing really, really forward-thinking, progressive op-ed pieces about the state of law regarding race and class, but he was also writing poetry about everything from the law regarding land ownership, to oil, to guardianship, to how our black veterans were treated upon their return from World War I.
I ask no special favors, nor seek for mine the best. I simply plead for justice for my own with all the rest. What right have you to curtail me, or I to hinder you? A right that's good for one should be for all, not a few.
In 1913, A.J. Smitherman decided to leave small-town Muskogee and go to Tulsa. He wanted to start his own newspaper. It was like California during the gold rush. Oil found on native land was lifting up the entire region. And so the story goes, a black man bought a lot of land from a Cherokee woman, and that area was the beginning of Greenwood. When Smitherman arrives, the streets are loud and bustling, crowded with people and wagons. And every few blocks, a family drives by in their brand new Model T Ford. Children fill their bellies with candies and sodas at the Williams Confectionery, while their parents puff on cigars and cigarettes. On Thursday nights, jazz bands play the latest tunes in the original Cotton Club. Sundays are reserved for church, family, and the best cuts of meat. The Dreamland Theater features vaudeville shows and screens silent movies featuring Mary Pickford and Charlie Chaplin. Another local jewel is the brand new Booker T. Washington High School, which rivals the best white schools in the state. For a young, ambitious man like A.J. Smitherman, Greenwood is ripe with opportunity. So on April 11th, 1913, he publishes the inaugural edition of The Tulsa Star, one of the first black daily newspapers in the United States.
Salutation. The Star comes to the citizens of Tulsa full of its sense of duty and wide awake to the grave of responsibility devolved upon it. We shall ask for and expect the cooperation of the best element of both races in our work here, and shall endeavor to maintain the friendly relationship between the two races.
The Tulsa Star launched just as Greenwood was becoming a destination for people all over the country, mostly black, but also white folks who were curious about the music scene, the food, or looking for the best mechanic in town.
Greenwood before the massacre was a black community on the rise. That's how I would describe it. My name is Victor Lukerson. I'm a journalist, an author. I'm living in Tulsa, working on a book about Black Wall Street.
So what have you learned? How would you describe Greenwood? What was it like there?
The story of Greenwood is so complex, and there's so much tragedy and trauma as part of it, but also so much inspiration. You saw all kinds of different businesses, from barber shops to beauty salons, doctor's offices, dentist's offices.
Smitherman opened his printing press with a loan from a local businessman. His new facility was worth more than $40,000, a pretty big accomplishment for the son of a coal miner. The Tulsa Star reported on the life of Greenwood and was a key booster in the community. Whenever a shiny new brick building went up, Smitherman would run a formal announcement. He also printed ads from all the new and thriving businesses. Victor's been studying maps and going deep into the archives of the Star.
So it was always kind of fun to see those sort of more upscale businesses, like a croquet garden, or they had like a furrier and a jeweler.
Ladies and gents, come on down to Williams Furniture Store. Even when you want furniture bad, you want it good.
And if you're hungry, North Greenwood Grocery Store has fine staple groceries of all kinds.
Or try Ragland and Ellis for waffles and plenty of other good things to suit the most fastidious.
In town for a visit, stay at the Stratford, the leading colored hotel of the Southwest.
Then stop by Ideal Cafe with home cooking and good things to eat.
Hello, I'm L.S. Neal, chiropractor and graduate of Chicago University. Make an appointment for all your back pain needs.
We're the Blue Goose Taylor Company, the place that satisfies everybody.
S.Y. Woodward here, the shoe doctor. Bring your shoes to me.
Hey there, come on by the Red Rose Cafe, a nice cool place to wait on the jitney.
Last but not least, I'm Sam Smith, the baggage man. I go while others stand.
The Greenwood District occupied about 40 square blocks in northwest Tulsa, and its wealth climbed along with the rest of the city. There were at least 3 recorded millionaires and many more families worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. People started calling it Black Wall Street. Of course, it wasn't perfect. The entire city of Tulsa was basically lawless.
This was definitely the wild, wild Midwest.
Raven Magia Williams, Smitherman's great-granddaughter.
I mean, a lot of people talk about Greenwood and Black Wall Street and its success, but there was a lot of poverty there. There were a lot of, like, illegal businesses.
It definitely had gangsters, and those gangsters had casinos and or gambling houses, as they called them. They had prostitution houses. When A.J. Smitherman moved to Tulsa, he realized that he had only visited in the day, and he had not accurately assessed just the degree of corruption and the ill ways of Tulsa at night, and how much the officials of the town were complacent and or participatory.
As the publisher of a daily newspaper, he had his eyes and ears in every corner of Greenwood, and he took it upon himself to clean up the streets.
He would literally put the address of a prostitution house in his newspaper and call out the commissioner, like, shut this place down.
No man could fight or die for a cause nobler and purer and more righteous than the fight we are making for pure homes and better moral conditions along East Archer Street, especially in the vicinity of the intersection with Cincinnati. This locality is a rendezvous for lewd women and their pimps. Tuesday afternoon, the editor of this paper had occasion to pass along the streets in this vicinity, and to his unholy expectation, saw a woman drunk, breaking the glass facing in the door and kicking the screen windows in, while she accompanied these wild, weird gymnastic stunts with language unfit for human ears.
One day, Smitherman was walking down the street, and one of the gangsters he called out approached him.
And the guy told him, if you put my name in your paper, you're going to be a dead man. And he said, oh, I'm going to put your name in the paper in the biggest print that I have tomorrow. So you must not know me like that.
Editor threatened with violence. The editor was halted on the street by one Charlie Gibson, who demanded to know who wrote the article which appeared in last week's issue of The Star about him.
He drove that guy out of town and shut down his cart house, his gambling house. But it also let people know that he wasn't going anywhere, that if anything, they were going to go somewhere, and he was going to hold them accountable in print.
The Star is for a better and greater Tulsa. We are here to stay, and we will do our part to make this a better place to live in.
Greenwood took care of itself. It had to. People there were constantly lobbying the city of Tulsa for access to basic services, like paved roads and sewer lines, municipal resources that they had paid taxes for. At the same time, black wealth added to Greenwood's prosperity. A man named Eli Grayson, who's the former president of the California Muscogee Creek Association, explained it like this.
Back in those days, because of Jim Crow laws, black people could only spend money among black people. They couldn't go to the white store, Macy's. They had to spend it in the black communities. And that dime that they spent there on a Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon went into that community, stayed in that community, rotated in that community up to 19 times.
Quraysh Ali Lansana.
The fact that O.W. Gurley lent J.B. Stratford money and Stratford loaned A.J. Smitherman money, and that a dollar bill could start at O.W. Gurley's business at 101 North Greenwood at the corner of Greenwood and Archer at sunrise and travel all the way up to Pine and back and be exchanged only by black hands. We can't do that now. I mean, that doesn't even happen in Harlem. You know what I mean? I don't know where that happened in Bronzeville on the south side of Chi. I don't know anywhere that, maybe Atlanta, right? But that's an extraordinary thing that happened in Greenwood from 1905 to 1921, that we kept our money in our communities and the kind of wealth and economic independence born out of necessity, right? Born out of the necessity of this Jim Crow segregation.
While looking through old newspapers, I was amazed by the many giants of Black history who visited Greenwood. People like W.E.B. Du Bois and Bill Basie, before people called him Count Basie. The artists and the thinkers who helped shape what Greenwood would become. A community so remarkable, so tenuous, constantly fighting for a fair shot. It wouldn't last.
That's Kalalea of the New Yorker Radio Hour reporting for Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning, a new podcast series about the forgotten history of Tulsa in 1921. And you can read Victor Luckerson's reporting from Tulsa at newyorker.com. Our story continues in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Many of us have learned for the first time recently about the Tulsa Massacre of 1921, the destruction of an entire community, a thriving Black district of homes and businesses. Greenwood was full of people who were striving for success, and there were many who had achieved it, who had pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, in the language of the time. We're hearing more and more about this lately because it's the centennial now of the Tulsa Massacre. And yet, while this is going on, the state of Oklahoma just passed a law that bans schools from teaching lessons that could cause, quote, discomfort, guilt, anguish, or psychological distress, unquote, to students because of their race or their gender. It's a measure that could muzzle the teaching of basic realities of American history, some of which are unavoidably distressing. And Oklahoma is not alone in introducing this kind of measure recently. Our producer, Kalalea, has spent months working on a podcast called Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning. Before the break, we were hearing about the editor of the Tulsa Star, one of the first Black daily newspapers in the country. Let's pick it up there.
A.J. Smitherman came to Tulsa in 1913, and the city was thriving. But it was also a time when the U.S. was gripped by racial violence in the years leading up to the massacre. Even as young Black men signed up to fight for America in World War I, answering Woodrow Wilson's call to make the world safe for democracy, white people would terrorize and lynch their Black neighbors. It was widely known and feared. Soldiers boarded trains in Oklahoma City and waved banners out the windows that read, "Do not lynch our relatives while we are gone." The request would not be honored. The violence actually intensified. The destruction was sometimes directed at entire neighborhoods.
Oftentimes when I'm lecturing about this, I have to talk very slowly because I'm trying to not break into tears. That's how bad it is.
Minka Makalani is a historian at the University of Texas, Austin.
Just to give one sense of how systematic they were with the violence is that they would start fires in the back of homes and then shoot people as they came out of the front door. And that's probably the least graphic description that I can give you of what some of the things that they did in East St. Louis.
East St. Louis, Illinois, July 1917. Over 3 days, whites ravaged a black neighborhood in the city, looting, assaulting, and killing people in horrific ways. Estimates varied, but it's believed they murdered over 100 and maybe as many as 250 African Americans. And some 6,000 fled the city. East St. Louis, like Greenwood and Tulsa, had been a community on the rise. Smitherman, the crusading newspaper publisher in Tulsa, wrote a telegram to the governor of Oklahoma denouncing an attack on a small town about 50 miles north of Tulsa called Dewey.
Dear Governor, Sunday night, August 11th, in Dewey, Oklahoma, the homes of 21 colored American citizens were destroyed by incendiary flames at the hands of a mob, and the colored inhabitants of that same town driven out by the same mob. At this time of our national crisis, while our black boys alongside our white boys are fighting, bleeding, and dying on the shell-plowed battlefields of France for the principles of democracy, surely we will not desecrate the cause for which they are giving their lifeblood by permitting the mob rule, which is worse than Kaiserism, to steal from us here at home all the essence of a true democracy.
The governor responded to the telegram and launched an investigation, but Smitherman also traveled to Dewey to report on the incident. I called 3 different research centers to ask if they had the issue of the newspaper with his investigation.
I'm looking for some archives.
I'd read about Smitherman's article in a book.
One second.
But none of the archives had that particular issue.
The only thing we have is...
They said it was missing from the microfilm.
Okay, you don't have actual newspaper archives either.
No.
And what's even more remarkable to me is that I learned that this sort of thing is pretty widespread. Accounts of racially motivated attacks, literally snipped out of archives and libraries, universities, and other collections. Like so many other stories about this period, we're just left with a gap in the record. But we do know that Smitherman's work brought visibility to what happened in Dewey, Oklahoma, and it led to something pretty incredible at the time. The arrest of 36 members of the mob, including the mayor. Not everyone was as connected or powerful as Smitherman, and efforts like his would not be enough. Around the end of the war, Klan membership exploded to around 100,000 members, and in 1919, whites lynched around 80 people in the U.S. 13 of them were African American veterans. The months of April to November of 1919 were so bloody that the poet James Weldon Johnson of the NAACP named it the Red Summer.
April 13th, a white mob burns a black church in Jenkins County, Georgia, and congregants try to escape. At least 4 people are killed.
May 10th, a group of white sailors attack a black man who allegedly did not step off the sidewalk for them in Charleston, South Carolina.
May 15th. A black man named Lloyd Clay is pulled out of jail, lynched, and burned.
A 72-year-old black man named Barry Washington is lynched by a mob.
Burn a courthouse. Lynch a black man named Will Brown and burn his body.
Attempts to lynch a man named Rob Ashton.
A riot follows. A black man is murdered.
Any black person they see using bricks.
Local law enforcement in Bisbee, Arizona plan an attack.
A homecoming celebration for African-American veterans is attacked.
A series of attacks between white and black sailors.
3 black churches and 1 community building is burned
They
down.
Shoot him over 1,000 times.
A stone to death by a group of whites.
New York turns into a race riot.
A
lynching mob of 300
attacks.
Rounded up 200 African Americans.
Between 100 and 250 black residents of Elaine, Arkansas are killed by white supremacist vigilantes and federal troops.
If you've ever lost a loved one or someone special, you're aware of the hurt and pain that comes with death, especially unexpected death. So just for a minute, imagine the people whose lives were irreversibly impacted by all the violence and hatred in 1919. And this list reflects only a small selection of the killings that made it in the news. There were more, hundreds more, that were never reported, never even investigated. And every death causes a ripple effect. The people who suffer the loss of their husbands, mothers, children, neighbors, not to mention the physical and psychological wounds, trauma from which some do not recover. And then to be told, there will be no funeral, no justice, no therapy, deal with it or get out.
If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot.
The summer of 1919 made it clear that the violence wasn't going to end, not without a fight. And so a quiet conversation began to get louder.
If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead.
This is Professor Makalani reading a poem by Claude McKay. It's called, If We Must Die.
O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave. And for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. This is a really defiant poem, and it's one that's really critical of the nature of white America at this time. And he's calling the white world that is engaging in this cowardly. He's saying they aren't men. But it is kind of reflective of the sentiment of the period, this defiance, this refusal to merely accept racial violence, but also a refusal to accept the society that says this kind of violence is appropriate if you don't follow the protocols that we've laid out.
In Black publications across the country, there were more calls to fight against the violence and oppression at home. Adrian Lynn Smith, a professor at Duke University, talk with me about a powerful essay by W.E.B. Du Bois called Returning Soldiers.
Where he basically gives that clarion call for the militancy that Black folks will need to fuel this freedom struggle, where he says, you know, we return to a country that lynches and degrades and abuses us. We return from fighting. We return fighting. And then he says, make way for democracy. We saved it in France, and by the great Jehovah, we will save it in the United States or know the reason why.
Hmm.
Which,
yeah, like, that's it.
That captures it. It still gives me chills. It is a beautiful piece of polemical writing.
I read it not too long ago, and I felt the same, like, wow.
And even A.J. Smitherman, the publisher of the Tulsa Star, was urging his readers to defend themselves.
No man should arm himself except for the purpose of self-protection or to uphold the majesty of the law. And when he is thus armed, no officer has any right to divest him of his arms, and he is a coward who would surrender his arms under such circumstances, regardless of the number against him. The Tulsa Star is unalterably opposed to mob violence, regardless of the color of the men composing the mob. And while we recognize the old adage that the pen is mightier than the sword, we have had some actual experience with the cowards who compose mobs, which has convinced us that two or three determined men armed for the occasion can thwart the purpose of any mob if they act in earnest and in time.
Which brings us to May 30th, 1921. the day a young African-American shoe shiner named Dick Rowland got onto an elevator operated by Sarah Page, a young white woman. What happened in the elevator is up for debate. The details don't seem to matter. Greenwood's fate was sealed. And here's another detail lost from the historical archives, that on the day of Rowland's arrest, the white-owned Tulsa Tribune ran an article with the headline, "To Lynch a Negro Tonight." It's missing from every record of that day's paper, like cut out. But we know about it because witnesses have described it. Smitherman helped organize a group of men to go to the courthouse and try to protect Rowland. When they got there, they spoke to the sheriff. Go home, he told them. He'd personally keep Dick Rowland safe. But the growing crowd of white people outside the courthouse suggested otherwise. They were screaming threats and getting more agitated with each passing minute. Smitherman and the others knew what would happen next. A few hours later, an even larger group of armed black men returned to the jail. Again, the sheriff declined their offer and sent them home, back to Greenwood. According to one eyewitness, just as they were marching away, a white man stepped out from the mob and tried to take a black man's gun away from him. The two men struggled over the weapon, two sets of hands, one white, one black, cursing one another and wrestling. And then, someone fired off a shot. Call it what you like, a race war, a riot, a massacre. But it had begun.
Blind Spot, Tulsa Burning, tells the story of the Tulsa Massacre in 1921. It's hosted by Kalalia, who's a producer for our program, and it was produced by the History Channel and WNYC Studios in collaboration with KOSU in Oklahoma City and Focus Black Oklahoma. You can find Blind Spot on any podcast platform. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm David Remnick. Thanks for listening today. See you next time.
The Blind Spot team includes Caroline Lester, Alana Casanova Burgess, Joe Plord, Emily Mann, Jenny Lawton, Emily Botine, Koresh Ali Lansana, Bracken Clar, Rachel Hubbard, Anakwa Gemina, Jamie Floyd, and Cheryl Duvall. The executive producers at the History Channel are Eli Lehrer and Jesse Katz. Raven Magia Williams is a consulting producer. AJ Smitherman was played by Maurice Jones. The music is by Hannes Brown, Amari Ford, Isaac Jones, and Chad Taylor.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.